Picture this. You've just rotated. You're maybe 200 feet above the runway, gear still in transit or just cleaned up, climbing at VY. The engine is running great. You're thinking about your first call to departure, and then it stops. Not a cough, not a shudder, it just stops. And the runway you just left is behind you, and the world ahead is whatever it is, trees maybe, rooftops, a road. You've got roughly 3 seconds before your brain overrides your training with instinct. 3 seconds to make the call that your pre-takeoff briefing should have already made for you. I'm Pattern, and this is Traffic Pattern on Radio Hangar. Today we're talking about the engine failure on takeoff, the scenario every student pilot practices and very few truly rehearse for, and the decision at the center of it that aviation instructors have argued about for decades, the impossible turn. Let me tell you up front, I call it the impossible turn because that's what most pilots call it, but the honest truth is that it isn't always impossible. The problem is that most of the time, at most altitudes, in most situations, it is, and the pilots who died trying to make that turn often thought they were in the minority. They weren't. Here's something I wish someone told me when I was training. The single most dangerous thing about an engine failure on takeoff isn't the emergency itself, it's the emotional pull of the runway behind you. That runway is known. It's flat, it's long, it's where you came from, and your brain is going to scream at you to get back to it. That instinct has killed people. That's what we're working through today. Before we get into the physics, I want to give a shout out to our friends at aviationsoul.com. They make challenge coins for every step of the pilot journey. First solo, private certificate, instrument rating, commercial, there's a coin for each milestone, and these make great gifts for the students and pilots in your life. If you're a student working toward that first big milestone, put this on your list, aviationsoul.com. All right, let's start with what the data shows. The National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, has investigated hundreds of accidents that follow the same pattern. Engine failure on departure, pilot attempts to return to the runway, aircraft stalls and spins during the turn, occupants do not survive. The variables change, the outcome does not. What the data keeps showing is this: pilots routinely underestimate how much altitude they need to make the turn safely, and they overestimate how well they will fly the airplane under stress at low altitude in the seconds after the most startling event of their flying life. So let's talk about what is actually happening when you try to turn back. First, you're going to lose altitude in the turn, you're banking, you're increasing load factor, you're pulling more on the wing. In a coordinated bank of 45 degrees, your stall speed increases by about 19%. In a coordinated bank of 60 degrees, you need to maintain 1.4 times normal stall speed just to keep flying. At low altitude with a dead engine, that margin is razor thin. Second, you have to think about heading. If your runway runs north-south and you took off heading north, you do not just turn 180 degrees to come back south. You have to account for wind. If you have a crosswind, the turn could be more than 180, could be 210 or 220 degrees of turn, depending on where the runway is, when you complete it. Third, you're not going to be going fast. You just rotated. You are somewhere between VX and VY, probably. You do not have a lot of excess energy to trade for altitude during the turn. Put all of that together, and here's what the numbers look like for a typical light training aircraft, a Cessna 172, something in that category. If you're at 500 feet above field elevation when the engine quits, research from the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, or AOPA, Air Safety Institute, and from independent aviation safety researchers, suggests that most pilots in most aircraft cannot complete a 180 degree turn and rollout aligned with the runway with enough altitude remaining to make a safe landing. Not reliably, not under stress. The number that gets thrown around a lot is 1,000 feet. That is where some instructors say you should be before you even consider the turnback option. But even that number is not universal. It depends on your aircraft's glide ratio, your bank angle in the turn, how tight you fly it, and how quickly you react. Some research puts it higher. The AOPA Air Safety Institute and the Experimental Aircraft Association, or EAA, have both published material suggesting that many aircraft, flown by average pilots under real-world stress conditions, need 1,200 to 1,500 feet of altitude to complete the return reliably. That is not 500 feet. That is not 700. That is somewhere between 1,200 and 1,500. And here is the uncomfortable truth. That means for a significant portion of the departure, when you are below that altitude and the engine quits, the runway behind you is not an option. It is not on the table. So what do? You land the airplane in the best available area ahead of you. I know that sounds frightening, and I know that when you picture it, you picture the worst possible terrain. But the key word is best available. That might be a road. That might be a field. That might be the overrun area at the end of the runway if you have not gotten very far. The goal is to put the airplane down in something survivable, under control at the lowest possible speed, and walk away from it. A controlled off-field landing is survivable the vast majority of the time. An uncontrolled stall spin at 200 feet is not. The airman certification standards for the private pilot check ride are pretty clear about what the examiner wants to see here. The examiner is looking for a pilot who establishes best glide, who identifies a suitable landing area, and who maintains control of the aircraft throughout. They are not looking for you to magically restart the engine or heroically return to the runway. They are looking for you to not kill yourself. Let me walk through what best glide actually means in practice, because this is one of those things that gets rehearsed in the pattern and forgotten in a real emergency. Best glide speed is the airspeed at which your aircraft travels the greatest horizontal distance for every foot of altitude lost. It is published in your pilot operating handbook. For a Cessna 172 Skyhawk, it is 68 knots. For a Piper Cherokee, depending on the variant, it is in the low 70s. Whatever your aircraft is, you should know that number before you get in the airplane. Not the general range. The specific number, when the engine quits, your first control input is pitch. You push forward or you release back pressure to establish best glide. Not too fast, not too slow. Right on the number. At best glide, you are maximizing the time and distance you have to work with. Above best glide, you are burning altitude faster than you need to. Below best glide, and you are dangerously close to stall, especially if you need to maneuver. Here is where training often falls short. We practice engine failures in the pattern all the time, but most of those practice failures happen at pattern altitude, downwind, or base, where you have a clear field, a known airport, and probably an instructor in the right seat. The muscle memory is built for that scenario. The departure scenario is different. The altitude is lower. The stress is higher. You do not have a runway in front of you. You have whatever is ahead, and you have a few seconds to process all of this and make a good decision. That is why the pre-takeoff briefing matters so much. And I mean an actual mental rehearsal, not just checking the controls and saying clear. Here is what a useful pre-takeoff briefing looks like. Before you advance the throttle, you think through this. If the engine fails before I rotate, I am stopping the airplane on the runway. If the engine fails right after rotation and I am below my altitude threshold, I am landing straight ahead, accepting whatever is there. If the engine fails and I am above that threshold, I will consider a turn back. That middle part, the altitude where you would consider a turn, is personal and aircraft specific. But for most training aircraft, flown by student pilots or newer private pilots, that number should be high, higher than you probably think. Some instructors put it at 1,000 feet for average pilots. Some put it at 1,200, a few put it even higher. The point of the briefing is that you make the decision before the emergency, not during it. The briefing short circuits the 3 seconds of brain freeze, the emotional pull toward the runway, the instinct that has gotten so many pilots killed. Here is something I wish someone told me when I was training. Chair flying this scenario is just as important as flying it in the airplane. Sit in your living room, picture the departure runway, picture the terrain beyond the departure end, and walk through the decision out loud. If the engine quits now, I land straight ahead. If the engine quits now and I have the altitude, I'm going to attempt a 180 to the left, keeping the airport on the inside of the turn, maintaining 45 degrees of bank, staying above stall. That kind of mental rehearsal is what separates the pilots who handle these emergencies from the ones who freeze. Now, let me say something about the pilots who have successfully made the turn back, because this is real and it does happen. Bob Hoover, one of the great aviators of the 20th century, was famous for demonstrating aircraft control in extreme situations, including deadstick landings that seemed impossible. But Bob Hoover was also a test pilot with thousands of hours and very specific training in that kind of flying. He is not the baseline for what we should expect of ourselves or our students at 200 hours. Some flight schools have developed specific training programs for the turnback maneuver, taking students up to altitude and actually practicing the mechanics of the turn so that if you are ever in a position where you genuinely have the altitude to make it, you have felt what it takes to do it right. That training has real value, but it does not lower the minimum altitude. It just teaches you to execute if you are above it. The other thing I want to address is how the runway behind you plays tricks on your perception. When you look over your shoulder at the departure end, the runway looks close. It always looks close. It looks reachable. But you're not looking at distance, you're looking at an angular impression. The actual geometry of where you are, where the runway is, what your glide path looks like, and what it will take to roll out on centerline is not something your brain reliably calculates under stress. This is why accident pilots so often report, in the moments before impact, that they thought they had it made. They thought the runway was right there. They were at 200 feet into the turn, the stall warning was going off, and they still thought they were going to make it pre-decide. That is the lesson. Pre-decide where your altitude cutoff is. Pre-decide to land straight ahead if you are below it, and then fly the airplane. Let me also cover the checklist, because your pilot operating handbook has an emergency procedures section, and your aircraft likely has memory items for engine failure. For most single-engine aircraft, it goes something like this. Establish best glide, fuel selector to the proper tank, mixture to rich, primer in and locked, magnetos to both, carburetor heat on, auxiliary fuel pump on, if equipped, attempt restart. All of that is valid. But it comes after you have stabilized the glide and identified your landing area. You do not run the restart checklist while staring at the engine gauges and forgetting to fly the airplane. Fly the airplane first, run the checklist second, in that order. The examiner will be watching to see that you prioritize aircraft control. That is the first task. The restart is secondary. And when you have committed to the off-field landing, your job in the final few hundred feet is to configure the aircraft to touch down as slowly as possible and protect the occupants. Flaps, when you have altitude to use them. A landing attitude, not a dive, using whatever length of field you have to bleed off speed. Turning off the fuel selector and magnetos before impact if you have time to reduce fire risk. Unlocking your door slightly so it does not jam on impact. All of this is in the Pilot Operating Handbook Emergency Procedures section. Read it. Chair fly it. Know it before you need it. The good news, and there is good news here, is that off-field forced landings in light aircraft are survivable at a very high rate when the pilot maintains control. The NTSB data bears this out. The fatal accidents in forced landing scenarios are disproportionately tied to loss of control, specifically stall spin, not to the terrain itself. A pilot who is flying the airplane all the way to touchdown, even into trees or brush, has a far better chance than a pilot who stalled at 200 feet trying to make the runway. Fly the airplane. That is the whole lesson. Really. Fly the airplane. Make the hard decisions before you need to. Know your altitude number. Know your best glide speed, know your emergency checklist, and never let the emotional pull of the runway behind you override the logic of what the altitude is telling you. Before every departure, especially at an unfamiliar airport, give yourself the briefing. Look at the departure end. Look at the terrain beyond it. Make the call ahead of time, then fly. The accident reports that break my heart are the ones where the instructor's notes say, the student was doing well, everything was coming together, and then one moment, one decision. Do not let the decision be made in the moment. Make it at the run-up area. Sources for this segment, the AOPA Air Safety Institute, the NTSB Accident Database, and the FAA's Pilot's Handbook of Aeronautical Knowledge. More at radiohangar.com. I'm Pattern. Fly the airplane. See you next time.